It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, a look at President Obama's visit to Waukesha earlier today. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
Our next guest wanted to find out why inmates with mental illnesses don't always take advantage of available mental health services after release from jail.
To help find out, she surveyed participants in a reentry program and asked them about what types of help they would need after release, and found that in terms of priority, seeking treatment for mental illness was pretty low on the list for them.
Amy Wilson joins us now. She's a professor at Case Western Reserve University, where she studies people with mental illness involved in the criminal justice system. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like it'd be a tough enough transition in any circumstance getting out of jail. For people dealing with mental illness, how much more complex does that make it?
Well, so I think you have to think of it in terms of the number of needs that are confronting them. It is hard for everybody, as you said, leaving jail or prison, but the sheer number of needs confronting people with serious mental illness can kind of boggle the mind. You have to think about that they have incredibly high rates of co-occurring substance use disorders, very high rates of poverty and homelessness prior to their incarceration, and high rates of comorbid medical conditions. So they have a lot of issues, not just their mental illness, that they have to address. And then in addition to that, the intensity or the severity of these different issues confronting them are really quite high. They often have a lot of symptoms related to their mental illness, long entrenched histories of substance use. And many people with serious mental illness live on public assistance programs by policy design. And that's, a very low level of money. And so they're constantly eking by, even when public assistance is working for them. And then the last thing you have to think about is that these aren't separate problems. And in the end, they all interact with each other in a way that really confounds our social service delivery system, which is, we call it a silo approach. Mental health services are designed to address the mental health problems, and then you're supposed to travel across town to another agency to deal with their substance use problems and somewhere else to deal with getting your public assistance. So you kind of get the sense there that a lot of effort has to be put out in terms of addressing all these needs.
If I'm understanding your work correctly, we're finding that even in cases where there is that mental health help available, people aren't using it, and you set out to survey why that is. What kind of things topped a priority list for somebody in this situation?
Right. That's a great question. I would add, I did a survey within the context of a year and a half that I spent doing ethnographic observation. So I followed along with the activities, observing, using participant observation in interviews, observing people's experiences. These were returning inmates and their case managers. So what tops our list above anything else is finding a place to live. And this is people with mental illness leaving jail. Over 70%, I'm one of the first people in the academic literature to ask the clients themselves to generate their list of service needs. Mostly, we've relied on professional judgment in the past for this. And so my goal was to see it from their perspective. And by and far, they said a place to live and money. And money to meet basic needs. Money to get food, to get clothing, and also, right, this feeds the cycle, to get a place to live. So these two things are very connected. Now, there were two questions in the survey you mentioned. The one said just list all the help areas of help that you need. And about 40% of people did say they needed either substance use or mental health treatment. And here's where I think it gets important. This is a distinction that we made. Then we said the second question was, now, if you could only choose two areas, what would be the two most important areas? And this is where you see the people who identify at treatment for their mental health or substance use, only 12% chose it as one of their top two, while housing and money stayed in the top two. 70% chose housing and 40% chose money as one of their top two categories of needs, if forced to choose. When you think about leaving jail, they are, in essence, forced to choose because they have so many needs confronting them that involve a lot of complex help seeking. They have to make decisions about where to start.
And you're talking about jail in particular here. And coming out of prison, I guess there's a predictable date. I'm out in a year. I'm out in 2 months. Jail is harder to predict, right?
Yeah, so that's there's a couple differences between jails and prison, and I believe most of it's driven by two things, just the magnitude. Okay, the prisons, I looked this up actually just recently, about 650 people entering and leaving prison each year. Well, there's 12 million people entering jails each year and 9 million leaving. So just the magnitude of it creates a crush that limits the ability to do good release planning. And then you've hit the other piece is the unpredictability. Jails have pretrial people, and so people can leave any day, any time. Even the best release planning can fail if people, you know, can leave unpredictably.
So what's at stake? What if people who could really benefit from this mental health assistance don't get it when they get out of jail?
Well, so I think there's a couple things at stake. The one is there's the impact on the individual, okay, because I hope I've been able to portray these are people with a number of needs, one of which is mental health treatment, and I don't want to obscure that. And the cost of not treating that for the individual can be great in terms of negative outcomes, you know, related to their health, their quality of life, related to their use of expensive community services like emergency rooms and hospitals. And it also, many people believe, is at least one of the drivers of their high rate of recidivism, right? So although there are probably other factors at play there as well. So there's a lot of costs to the individual, to the community through services and the jail and the correctional system for not being able to deal with this.
You mentioned the silo approach where maybe food assistance is over here, living assistance is over here, mental health here. What would be a better way? Do you have a sense of what would make a better approach where people would get all the assistance they need maybe in one place?
Well, I mean, that's the ideal. And when you talk to people who talk about reentry planning from jails and prisons, and we've seen some movement in that way, this idea of this one-stop shopping. And that certainly, almost any, I think, reentry planner or person building a program is going to tell you, I mean, that's the dream. And what a lot of programs have been able to achieve around the company, to their credit, around the country, is you're creating a place where all these different services come in and try to engage the person. But that's just the point of entry, and it's a great start. But, you know, still, to get all of the services that they learn about in these one-stop shops, they still have to do this, what I call a scavenger hunt, approach to services when they first get out. And that requires, just think what it requires to get all over a city or a town. You have to have transportation or money for it. You have to have basic neat things like weather-appropriate clothing that fits. And these, you know, I observed a number of people being released, and many people lack these things when they leave jail. And I think that's shocking for a lot of us. But, you go into jail and you leave with jail with what you had when you went in, and often the weather, the season has changed. And also people can put on weight in jail just based on the nature of the food that they eat. So, you know, so things change, but their resources don't change. And, you know, so, I always say dealing with the problem holistically. Now that's a challenge, and I know that's a challenge to policymakers, but I think we have to recognize the connection between meeting a person's basic needs and how that facilitates their ability to get into treatment. And although I think intellectually many of us recognize that, we're not seeing that played through in policy.
You mentioned that you surveyed the inmates and people who are out. You did an ethnographic approach. You talked mm-hmm. to them, probably interviewed them. Were they surprised that somebody was asking them what they thought they needed?
Yes, it was deeply humbling. That is that I appreciate that question. Some people were really surprised, and they were very honored that they saw somebody, you know, from a university, right? You know, the professor, they called me sometimes, you know, and where I just tried to blend in and be like them. But, you know, they were very surprised. And some people would dress up for some of the formal interviews, and they took this very seriously. But honestly, you know, as I went along and followed along with I was focused on their help-seeking activity, so that's their part of their life I followed along with. You know, there was a lot of frustration in talking to me about, you know, make this matter, you know, help people see that how hard this is.
Do you think there will be more research like what you're doing? Do you think policymakers will start trying to look toward the kind of thing you're doing as they try to solve these problems?
You know, I certainly hope so. And I should say that there have been a lot of movement towards trying to get people with mental illness leaving jails and prison faster access to Medicaid. And that's a health insurance program. And that's important, and I recognize that. But health insurance helps us provide the mental health treatment. My argument is we also need to be focused on removing these extensive barriers or somehow dealing with the number of barriers there are to getting cash assistance, because this is a population we want to be able to get on public assistance. This is how we support them in many of these individuals in the community. But it's our country as a relationship with giving out cash assistance has a long history, complicated history. And I know this is very hard for policymakers to address, but we must. If we can't find a way to meet their basic needs, it just goes to reason that if somebody is struggling to find food to eat and a place to sleep, that they can't even think about mental health treatment.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amy Wilson. She's a professor at Case Western Reserve University. She studies people with mental illness involved in the criminal justice system.